Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
And again from New Orleans, ladies and gentlemen. Two words. Two little words. The Sunday Morning Yak shows this week were filled with representatives of the Bush administration. Somebody opened the coffin, and there they came, walking out, to opine on the killing of Osama bin Laden. Dick Cheney looking good, looking better, on Fox, Donald Rumsfeld, I think on Meet the Press. They were all out there. And among the things, among the items on their agenda, ladies and gentlemen, was, you know, this enhanced interrogation really paid off. We really should go back to it. And to buttress their case, I said buttress their case, they cited statements by Leon Panetta and some other folks saying, well, we got intelligence from enhanced interrogation. Fairly ambiguous statements about getting some leads from enhanced interrogation. And by enhanced interrogation, of course, we're talking about waterboarding and other things that are, last time I looked, prohibited by international law. Pardon me. And but it's the ambiguity of those statements that they were citing that reminded me of something, of those two little words I mentioned at the top here, that were not spoken by any of the tough interrogators on the Sunday Morning Yak shows as this story was being laid out before them. And those two words are false leads. And the best I can find out from what I read, the enhanced interrogation techniques produced a lot of false leads as these guys lied and gave out, oh, said, oh, he's not, in terms of the courier that, in fact, ultimately led to Osama bin Laden. I believe it was Alibi, one of the high-value detainees, said, oh, he's retired. He's not working for him anymore. And others gave false leads, which, according to some observers, took intelligence agencies time, resources to chase down, time and resources that they might have used to, you know the rest of that. Anyway, yes, the push for bringing waterboarding back has begun, ladies and gentlemen. Strap in. The new F-bomb. A small group of private investors have, and listen to this. This is apropos of what Bill Black was talking about on last week's broadcast. This is just a new wrinkle that you just scratch your head and say, lawyers are simultaneously being overpaid and not being paid enough because they think of stuff like this, if this is true. A small group of private investors has overpaid taxes on more than 100 Florida real estate purchases since January of last year, which had the effect of artificially inflating the recorded sales prices to show that the properties sold for $2.77 million more than the investors paid, showing paper profits. The pattern of overpayments emerged in an Orlando Sentinel review of thousands of foreclosure auction records kept by the Orange County, Florida Clerk of Courts. The Sentinel analysis showed 101 examples of so-called grossed-up sale prices. They grossed them up. That is so grossed up. Overpayments of taxes after the foreclosure sales first came to light a couple months ago when the newspaper became aware of 11 cases. The number of confirmed cases grew nearly tenfold with the review. By overpaying the tax, investors increased the recorded sale prices for their purchases, disguising the eventual profits made when flipping many of the properties to new buyers. Yeah, I barely understand it, but it's just, as I say, lawyers are being both simultaneously underpaid and overpaid. Hey, what's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers up to? Glad you asked. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers released documents this week acknowledging it was responsible for using a racially inflammatory version of the name Negro Hill when that town's cemetery was moved to El Dorado Hills, this is near Sacramento, to make way for Folsom Lake in 1954. Negro Hills Old Cemetery on the land between forks of the American River was one of several moved when Folsom Dam was built. Instead of saying Negro Hill, though, markers in the new Mormon Island Cemetery, it just gets better, to which the bodies were taken, instead used a word too raw to be used in the newspaper that published this story. We'll get Mark Furman in to recite it for you if you'd like to hear it. They say the bodies were moved from N-word Hill. Let's go N-word, shall we? The markers don't refer to those buried there who were likely of various races, but only to the town's name. We don't know why, when in so many other instances the cemetery was called Negro Hill, the new gravestones and our records use the more offensive word, wrote Corps of Engineers Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Kiger in an apologetic memo accompanying the release documents. The community was founded as Negro Hill in 1848 by at least one settler of African descent. Most historical maps refer to it by that name. At least two use the offensive name, including a 1944 U.S. Geological Survey map. That may be what the Corps of Engineers used. El Dorado County has begun a process to fix the markers while acknowledging the racist history that made the fix necessary. No mention in this story of why it's called Mormon Island, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. We can't report everything. You can't insult everybody. Really? News of the godly, newly appointed arch... And who would have thought that priestly abuse would spread all the way down to Chile? All the way down Chile way. Newly appointed Archbishop Fernando Chomali of Concepcion, Chile, affirmed that the Catholic Church, is committed to, quote, taking the bull by the horns on cases of sexual abuse, so they never take place again. Might want to review the metaphor. Just a suggestion. Just a serving suggestion. He added, anyone who commits such crimes must answer to civil authorities. He condemned the abuse committed by popular Chilean priest Father Fernando Caradima because, first of all, quote, it is a scandal, and second, it is denial of what the priesthood is itself, unquote. Oh, one more quote. We are not above the law. We are citizens, and we must give an example, unquote. The priest, Father Caradima, was found guilty of sexual abuse after an investigation carried out by the Archbishops of Santiago. His punishment? He was ordered to retire to a life of prayer and penance. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of Hello, Welcome to the Show. Maybe it was aggravated penance.
Tuesday, babe, you don't love me. Wednesday, you ain't home. Thursday night, you got it wrapped up tight, girl. Still, I can't get you alone. Or would you let me know? What you know, when you know it, what you know. If you know something good, take your time. I don't mind. If I could, you know, I surely would be good to you. I'll be good to you. Saturday we ain't speak. Sunday, babe, I bake your chocolate cake. You can't even give me a please. Let me know what you know, when you know it, what you know. If you know something good, take your time, baby. I don't mind.
could, you know I surely would be good to you. I'll be good to you.
From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer. Right by where they're putting in the new pumps. It'll only be three more years. I'm Harry Shearer welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. These pumps may work. And now, ladies and gentlemen, of course, there's no telling. Tales of airport security is what we're fixing to do for you here. Ain't fixing it, ain't broken. Bill writes, Dear Harry, we just returned from a vacation in Puerto Rico. Going through security at Marin Airport. Wow, who knew? We noticed that there were two lines, one of which had the new X-ray machine, and one that had the old-style metal detector. Unfortunately, we'd already gotten into the former, and I told my partner that I was going to opt out and risk the junk touching. She said, why not just move to the other line? Clearly, I'm not the brains of this operation. We changed lines, nobody from the TSA even blinked, and threw the metal detector. We went. No issues with my 4-inch metal bookmark that could possibly double as a box cutter, nor with our liquids and gels, which, despite TSA instructions, were left in our carry-ons. I wouldn't mind being inconvenienced by truly effective airport security, a la El Al in their interviews, but if they're just going to phone it in, I want to go through as little fuss as possible. And we did. Thank you, Bill. Tales of airport security, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now we get to the buried lead in today's broadcast, which involves our friend the Atom, although it's not Addie's. Addie's segment comes moments from now, but he's listening behind the soundproof door. Here's the lead of the story. The U.S. government could face fines of $75,000 a day if it fails to find a way to store or handle stockpiles of defense-related nuclear waste by 2035, according to the Government Accountability Office. So that's the lead is that. In a report this week, the GAO says the Energy Department initially planned to move the waste currently stored at locations in five states to Yucca Mountain. But the administration's efforts to abandon Yucca are leaving the department without a long-term solution. If the Energy Department cannot find a way to store or handle the waste in the next 24 years, it will eventually violate agreements it has with two of the states in which the waste is located. That's the story. So the good people at Market Watch, that's the lead. But way down here, use your miner's helmet, because here it is, comes this sentence. Because the law requires the U.S. government to be responsible for the waste, the government has to compensate the power plants for the cost of storing it. That's right. We agree to be responsible for the waste, ladies and gentlemen. What other business gets to say that? You, government. Oh, no, we're self-sufficient, proudly market-based private industry, but here, government, take our waste. You're responsible. Thank you. We'll call you later if you don't do it. And now,
clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
Addie?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Okay, our friend the Atom is in the room, is in the house, we're supposed to say now, aren't we? Or has that gone? No, you're still wearing baggy jeans and putting tattoos on women, so I guess we can still say in the house. The scramble, if this doesn't twist your mind into even just a little knot, I'm not talking about, you know, a granny knot or something, just a little tiny kink, then you're not listening. The scramble to cool the Fukushima nuclear complex with seawater in the aftermath of the thing puts a spotlight on just how much cold water an atomic reactor needs to function, and not just in a crisis, just every day because of the thing. All existing nuclear plants use vast amounts of water as a coolant. In recent years, often far from the public eye, hot river and lake temperatures have forced nuclear power plants worldwide to decrease generating capacity. That's right. The warming that nuclear plants are supposed to help prevent is forcing the closing down of some nuclear plants because the water is too hot to cool them. You with me so far? Experts say the problem is only getting worse as climate change triggers prolonged heat waves, prompting calls for changes in siting processes. Yeah, that'll fix it. Move farther from the water. I'm sorry. Did I miss something there? Quote, as a long-range strategy, the industry might change where we site new plants to have better use of water resources, said Gary Vine, an independent consultant. Vine has worked in the nuclear industry for decades and is a former employee of the Electric Power Research Institute, a utility group. There's also hope that new technologies will help mitigate the problem. Well, there always is, isn't there? And what happens to that? Why, it can't cost any energy to cool the water, can it? The U.S. Department of Energy is part of an international team working to design the next generation of nuclear plants, some of which will use less water than traditional plants. But the project faces numerous challenges, such as cost and implementation barriers. Cost? Implementation? No. The DOE anticipates that the new generation reactors will not be commercially available for at least two decades. And by then, climate effects, says the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, must figure into a utility's decision to build nuclear facilities. Climate change studies published in research journals such as Science and the Journal of Climate project longer and more intense heat waves over the next century worldwide, adding constraints to water-intensive power systems. Nuclear plants, here's a little figure to stick in your craw. Nuclear plants consume up to 25% more water than fossil fuel plants. And I have to say, because it's radio, Addie is sitting looking very proud of that right now.
Hey, I'm busting my buttons.
He is indeed. U.S. regulators need to improve the security for used nuclear fuel stored in steel and concrete containers, according to a government watchdog. Hope they're feeding that dog. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has no central database of security-related information for so-called dry cask storage, and doesn't have a comprehensive document outlining the roles and responsibilities of staff, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's Inspector General. Regional offices also use different groups of employees to monitor dry cask installations, so there's no forum for communication. These are the ways that waste is stored. Well, we can't put it in Yucca Mountain, you see. This could negatively impact NRC's mission to ensure adequate protection of public health and safety, promote the common defense security, and protect the environment, according to the report. They need to improve the security for used nuclear fuel, you see. But no threat to public health by the lack of security. But I'm sure they would say that if they had a spokesman to say that. Dateline Port Gibson, Mississippi, an unknown amount of radioactive water was released accidentally into the Mississippi River late last week because the river isn't having enough problems. At the Grand Gulf nuclear station. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is investigating the incident. It suggests, this is the wording from the Natchez Democrat newspaper, the NRC suggests the release poses no public health hazard. That's a suggestion. There are other suggestions that could be made. They suggest. Somebody sat a while and thought about the choice of that verb. Insists? Assures? No. Suggests. Entergy Nuclear, which operates Grand Gulf, filed a report with the NRC explaining that crews located standing water at the plant last week after the area experienced heavy rains. It's good for the mosquitoes. Water was found at Unit 2 Turbine Building, which is an abandoned, partially constructed building, and began pumping the raw water into the river. An alarm apparently alerted workers to the presence of our old friend tritium. The pumps were turned off, stopping the flow. Investigators are not certain why tritium was in the stormwater or how it got there. God sent it. Although the concentrations of tritium exceeded EPA drinking water limits, the release should not represent a hazard to public health because of its dilution in the river, says Lara Uselding, a PR person with the NRC. So I guess that's the suggestion. It shouldn't do it. It shouldn't be a health hazard. Okay, then. Tell the tritium. Tritium has several uses. I don't really need to know how to use tritium. Information from the EPA suggests exposure to tritium increases the risk of developing cancer because tritium emits low-energy radiation and is processed through the human body quickly. It's considered one of the least dangerous radionuclides. And another problem, This time with emergency equipment at Southeast Nebraska's Kupler Nuclear Station is adding to the cost of the plant's refueling shutdown, a cost that could hit power customers' pocketbooks. But it's cheap. The cost of the shutdown, originally budgeted at $31 million, has increased by $5 million as a result of the problem. The plant was taken offline in March for routine refueling operation. A problem with an emergency backup generator was discovered during a test. Same spokeswoman for NRC reports this. The generators can be critically important, as we've learned from Japan. The corporate nuclear business manager for the site said he doesn't know how much more it will cost ratepayers for electricity from other sources while the plant remains shut down, because it is so darn cheap when it's running. Testing the evacuation of residents near U.S. atomic power plants would be difficult before an emergency, says the chairman of the NRC, Gregory Yaksko. Running mass evacuations on a trial basis is a challenge, he said, answering a question from Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader? Really? Interesting. Evacuation plans are being examined in the agency's 90-day review after the Fukushima thing. Nader said Yaksko would be in charge of possibly the most difficult evacuation process in U.S. history in the event of a nuclear accident or reactor sabotage. He said real-life drills should be conducted of all evacuation plans. Yaksko replied, state, local, and utility officials conduct exercises every 2 years at nuclear plants to test emergency communications. He called those a reasonable approximation for how the evacuations should work. Two words. Hurricane Pam, an exercise conducted among all state, local, and federal officials testing hurricane communications a year or two before Katrina. Check it out, Gregory. And Lower Alloways Creek Township in New Jersey checks in with this cheery news. A southern New Jersey nuclear power plant has been taken offline for the third time in 2 weeks, so crews can clear vegetation that's blocking cooling water intakes. Yes, the Salem 1 reactor was taken offline. Wasn't known when it will go back online. Officials blame the shutdowns on, and here's a new one for your dictionary, ladies and gentlemen, grassing. A problem caused by vegetation, weeds, and grasses that grow along the Delaware River and its tributaries. I bet it happens somewhere else, too. The vegetation becomes dislodged and floats downstream and can become especially troublesome in the spring. It's clean, it's cheap, it's safe. Just watch out for the grassing. Addie, watch out for the grassing on your way out.
I'm aware of that, thank you.
They tried the handcuffs, but they won't lock. Electrical courses, but they won't shock. You pulled the fire alarm. You tried punching a cop. You're just too tired to stop. You old pine box. You old pine box. With your head full of rocks, sharp like a crack.
This is the show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, I'll read the trades for you. This is sort of newsworthy from Media Daily News. Big Bang, TV universe declines for the first time ever. Oh, you bet I'll read it for you. The percentage of U.S. households with television has declined for the first time ever.
Ever.
According to new TV universe estimates released this week by the Nielsen Company. That's one universe that's shrinking. The data, which Nielsen described as advanced and preliminary, meaning don't blame us, were derived from computations based on the census and shows that the percentage of U.S. households with a TV set will have declined by more than 2 percentage points, from 98.9% currently to 96.7% when the new estimates go into effect. The finding may be the first official proof yet that Americans are cutting cords and pulling plugs. Reasons may be a combination of societal shifts, especially access to alternative sources of video programming, including that damn internet. Consumers are viewing more video content across all platforms rather than replacing one medium with another, Nielsen said, adding that a small subset of younger urban consumers seem to be going without paid TV subscriptions for the time being. You're paying for TV? Nielsen added, Nielsen, like this is a person at this point. The Nielsen Company added that, quote, the long-term effects of this are still unclear. Yeah, well, I wouldn't want to be president of NBC. That's one effect. You know, Donald Trump has the number one show on NBC. That tells you all you need to know about NBC. No, but let's get back to the story here. It's undetermined, says Nielsen, if this is also an economic issue that will see these individuals entering the TV marketplace once they have the means, or the beginning of a larger shift to online viewing. Because it's urban, you know. It's right now, it's just urban. You know, like those urban people that live in urban areas. You see what I'm saying? Like that urban hill where the cemetery was. Nielsen cited three factors leading up to the first ever downward revision in the TV household universe, including the shift from analog to digital. Yes. The digital wonderland strikes back. That displaced a number of TV households that failed to convert. Huh. Who saw that coming? And the economic effects of the recession. There's a recession? Along with the increased availability of multi-platform viewing options as reasons for the decline. A number of big advertising agencies and advertisers have already shifted from a view of, quote, buying television, unquote, to buying video, including online video. And I would add those little video screens on top of gas pumps. Those are good. That's where I do my TV viewing. Because you get the show and you get the smell. The show and the smell, ladies and gentlemen. Formula that occurs to me when I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature this broadcast. And now news of AFAC. They got a new AFAC guy. It's not me. And I didn't want the job. So, three words. Our friend Pakistan. Those are words I've been saying, as you know, if you've been listening for a long time, since, 2003. The criteria, you may remember, for invading Iraq included three major criteria. Invading a neighbor country, harboring terrorists, and possessing weapons of mass destruction. And from that moment when those three criteria were made public, on this broadcast, the host of this program asked one question. Okay, it's arguable about Iraq, but we know one country where all three criteria are met, our friend Pakistan. Yes, indeedly doodly. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we have this this rush to explain the rush of misinformation or uninformation that came out in the immediate aftermath of the killing of Osama bin Laden. Administration spokesmen have rushed to the Sunday Yak shows to say, well, fog of war. Fog of war, after they said that that photograph we saw was of all the top people in the White House, including the president and the secretary of state, with her hand over her mouth. Oh, my God. Watching real-time video feeds of the operation. Then Leon Panetta went on PBS and said, oh, the video feed cut out during when they went into the house. And then Bob Woodward in the Washington Post over the weekend said, no, they were watching real-time video feed. But the fog of war had them saying that Osama was armed when he wasn't, had them saying he used a human shield when he didn't. It's just, you know, that kind of fog. You know, it's late night and early morning, low clouds and human shield kind of fog. As I mentioned earlier, the Bush administration representatives have been rushing to say, oh, well, this was all based on intelligence we got way back when George Bush enhanced thing. We wouldn't have. So just for informational purposes, ladies and gentlemen, here's what we knew back when thought back when George W. Bush was president.
Well, as I say, we hadn't heard much from him. And I wouldn't necessarily say he's at the center of any command structure. And, you know, again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
Osama bin Laden he's talking about. Not that concerned. He's not at the champion thing. Not the head of the thing. So that's that fine information that he was getting way back when we were enhancing our interrogations. Here's what we know now, ladies and gentlemen. Osama bin Laden had not ventured beyond two rooms for 5 years. That's an average of a room every 2.5 years. That was the million-dollar mansion. That was another thing that we said, our government said originally. A million-dollar mansion. Did you see that dump? Wow. This information, the two rooms for 5 years, is according to the reported testimony of Osama's wives, three wives who were captured during the U.S. raid. This wife, Sada, who's believed to have been shot in the calf after rushing at U.S. Navy SEALs, believed, said she'd remained on the upper floors of the house since moving there in 2006. Bin Laden had also lived there for that period, she said to confirm, since 2006, in a community that also housed the Pakistani Military Academy and a number of retired military officials' residences. Sada said while her husband was living in the house, he never left two rooms, one of them the bedroom where he was killed. He never went anywhere. The wives had been taken to Islamabad for questioning by the Pakistanis. U.S. investigators had not been given access to the wives, and given the tensions following the raid, this is unlikely to happen. So maybe they'll join AQ Khan. We haven't been able to question either. Meanwhile, of course, Pervez Musharraf, the former president of Pakistan and chief of the army, says, I do agree that the news about bin Laden living in Pakistan is surprising, and a lot of people in Pakistan are not believing that. This is unfortunate. It needs to be investigated. Who slipped up? Why this negligence? Musharraf said it was complete surprise that Osama has been in Pakistan since 2006. He has long denied that Osama was even in Pakistan. Musharraf was ruler of Pakistan from 1999 to 2008. He also passionately defended Pakistan's efforts at tracking down al-Qaeda terrorists. Then on CNN, Musharraf denied that he ever said Osama was not in Pakistan. He has been... and he also criticized the U.S. for carrying out the mission to kill Osama without coordinating with Pakistani authorities, who are believed to, at least in some cases, have been supporters of al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So Musharraf, making appearances on a lot of media, and about to make another one.
From Afghanistan Public Radio, where we never defund ourselves.
From the newly defortified presidential palace in downtown Kabul, the city that never wakes up, I'm Walid.
And I'm Hamid. We're Cluck and Schmuck, the Who Knew Brothers.
Welcome to another edition of Cars I Talk.
And today's program comes to you with the assistance of the American government, sending unaccountable checks since 2004. Wow. What a week my younger brother and I have had.
That's right. We couldn't have been more excited if we'd been living in a mansion in a butterbed.
No. Well, this is another piece of wisdom we've picked up during the past few days. If you're up against people who may shoot you in the eye, wear sunglasses.
Well, my goodness, Osama bin Laden is no more. I remember him when he was just a glorified errand boy for the Mujahideen.
If by glorified errand boy you mean the guy who showed up with the gold card.
You know, I never thought he hated America. Mm. I just thought he hated American Express.
But I have to say, my dear younger brother, I disagree with you on one thing.
Oh, what's that? Which company to use to ship the opium? I keep telling you, logistics is not your strong suit.
No, no, I know, but...
When we find your strong suit, I'll be sure to tell you.
All right, but I do think President Obama was right not to release photos of the dead Osama.
Oh, I know. He says, this is not who we are. Mm. Have you seen half of the top-grossing American movies from last year? They make Osama's photos look tamer than camels on Prozac.
Maybe so, but if I were an al-Qaeda sympathizer, seeing that photograph would only make me more militant.
Dear older brother, if you were an al-Qaeda sympathizer, you wouldn't be running Afghanistan.
No, I'd be running Pakistan. Hello, you're on Cars I Talk.
Hello, I'm Perez, a first-time caller. Until recently, I was too busy running
the... Where are you first-time calling from, caller?
Well, I'm in London right now. I was going to go back to Pakistan, but according to what I hear, the allergies this year have been a bitch.
Well, you only know that because half your intelligence agency is supporting the allergies.
Well, so should we call you Mr. President or Mr. General or General President or...
Just don't call him Mr. Mister. Our format doesn't include the 80s.
President for life will be fun.
Or president for the next life.
So, Pervez, do you have a question for us?
Well, yes. How is it that just a couple of years after I left the scene that the Americans can run this kind of operation in my country without the knowledge of our intelligence and military people? Does that make sense to you?
Makes about as much sense as you coming back to Pakistan.
No, dear brother, it is a serious question.
And it deserves a flippant answer.
Well, to be honest with you, caller.
Oh, now you start with the honesty.
To be honest with you, I wonder if your country's intelligence and military people didn't want to be unaware of this particular operation.
So you're saying kind of a need to to not know situation.
Well, while we're at it, dear caller, why would Mr. Bin Laden choose to live in a city notorious for a large military installation and high levels of military security?
Well, just off the top of my head, I think even terrorists like to feel safe.
I know callers are supposed to be asking us the questions, but I'd just like to pose this one.
Yes.
Did you know Mr. Bin Laden was in Abbottabad?
Oh, goodness. I was as surprised as the next man. Of course, to be fair, the next man here works for me. But no, this sort of thing just wouldn't have happened in my day.
You know, they're now saying that he lived there since 2005.
Well, that was the afternoon of my day. But still, you know, they're also saying, Wali, that you traffic in heroin, and Hamid, that you're a bipolar personality.
Hey, at least I have a personality.
And you know, another, if released those home videos of him, they said it was a $1 million mansion. You'd have to pay me $1 million just to live in that rubbish.
Something on the wall, a picture, some wallpaper. That doesn't cost $1 million.
No.
I could buy that with the proceeds of one day's poppy crop, if I did what they say.
And don't forget the three wives.
Yeah.
I'd say he was punished enough even before he was shot in the eye.
Well, my final question for you guys is, do you think this incident will help bring Pakistan and Afghanistan closer together, as our Prime Minister was trying to suggest?
Me, personally, I've had some experience with the Americans when they're feeling badly used. You're calling from London?
Yes, sir.
Well, for the next little while, that's about as close as I'd like to be to Pakistan. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
He didn't reverse the charges, did he?
I think he Skyped us.
We had help today from mysterious people with big bags of cash.
Legal services for Carly Talk by the law firm of Ketchum & Newcomb. I'm Hamid.
And I'm Wally. Join us next week for another edition of Cars I Talk. Don't bribe my brother.
Don't bribe my brother. This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
I hand you my ball and chain. You just hand me that same old refrain. I'm walking on a wire. I'm walking on a wire. But I'm falling. I wish I could please you tonight, but my medicine just won't come right. I'm walking on a wire. I'm walking on a wire. But I'm falling. Steps to take, too many spells to break, too many nights awake, and no one else. This grindstone's wearing me, and your clothes are tearing me. Don't use me endlessly, it's too long, it's too long to myself. Where's the justice and where's the sense? All the pain is on my side of the fence. I'm walking on a wire. I'm walking on a wire. And I'm full. Too many spells to take, too many spells.
those rhinestones wearing me, and your clothes are tearing me. Don't use me endlessly. It's too long. It's too long to myself. Scares you when you don't know, the trouble with the wind might blow. I'm walking on a wire, I'm walking on a wire, but I'm falling. I'm walking on a wire, walking on a wire, but I'm falling. I'm walking on a wire, I'm walking on a wire, I'm falling.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Republican Senator John Ensign of Nevada, not to be confused with Republican Senator John Ensign of Nevada apologized to his colleagues in the U.S. Senate this week for what he called his arrogance and belief in his own importance. Imagine a senator. Ensign, once a rising GOP star, is officially leaving Congress this week under an ethics cloud stemming from his extramarital affair with a former aide. I was blind to how arrogant and self-centered I had become, Ensign said. I did not recognize that I thought mostly of myself. The worst part about this is that I even tried not to become caught up in my own self-importance. Unfortunately, the urge to believe in it was stronger than the power to fight it. This is how dangerous the feeling of power adulation can be, he said. This ends a nearly two-year saga that began with the admission that he'd had an affair with the aide, once a close friend of his wife. In an extraordinary admission, Ensign said he was wrong to judge his former colleagues and Republicans Larry Craig and Ted Stevens when they were going through scandals of their own. At the time, Ensign was chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, and he had called for both to resign from the Senate. He said he later apologized to both Craig and Stevens. He then apologized to the Senate, quote, for what each of you have gone through as a result of my actions. I know that many of you were put in difficult situations because of me, and for that, I sincerely apologize. Dateline Los Angeles, Laker coach Phil Jackson. No, not about that. He's formally apologized for a recent comment about Sacramento Kings owners Joe and Gavin Malouf. Before Monday's series opener with Dallas, oh, too bad about that, he's written an apology for his comments comparing the Maloofs to Dodgers owner Frank McCourt, whose team is now being overseen by Major League Baseball. Before Game 2 of the Lakers' first-round series with New Orleans, Jackson was asked what he thought about the Dodgers situation. He said, I think it's the same thing with the Maloofs in Sacramento, a similar situation there. I can see where the league had to step in and monitor that. It's unfortunate for our fans here. Hopefully the Dodgers will recover. Jackson was asked if he'd actually handwritten a letter to the Maloofs. Yes, he said, I had a gun at my head, but laughter drowned out the rest of his comment. The Maloofs were upset enough about being compared to McCourt, who has reportedly run up almost $500 million in debt and had to borrow money to make Dodger payroll last month, that they sent an attorney to the home of a writer for an Orange County newspaper seeking a tape of Jackson's comment. The Register did not turn over the tape. The Oklahoma House of Representatives voted this week to reprimand a state lawmaker who denigrated blacks and women during a debate on an affirmative action bill last week. Representative Sally Kern, Republican of Oklahoma City, delivered a tearful apology on the House floor, then voted for her own reprimand. The chairman of the Norwalk, Connecticut school board has publicly apologized for using the word shekels during a heated budget discussion after some teachers called the remark a jab at the city's sizable Jewish population. Osama bin Laden apologized to all his children for not being a good father to them in a will he wrote 3 months after the September 11th attack. He even warned his offspring not to join the al-Qaeda group. A local Chicago bar apologized this week for a party they had planned to celebrate the killing of bin Laden. Our intention was never to offend anyone, says a representative of Uncle Fatty's. Toronto City Councilor Doug Ford apologized this week for any confusion stemming from his comments about the city's hopes of landing an NFL franchise, saying he should not have included the New Orleans Saints as a potential prize to be grabbed by Toronto. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want, at harryshear.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone at Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast at KCRW.com. And it'd be just like seeing that photo of Osama bin Laden if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Already, thank you very much. Hey, we saw Uday and Hussein, and we lived. That's who we are. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halston, and thanks to Bob Dunn here at WWNO for helping to make today's show such a gas. The email address and the music heard hereon, the playlist thereof, a feature, a sterling feature of harryshear.com. And you can catch up with the host of this broadcast throughout the week at... on Twitter, at The Harry Shearer. Join the 33,000, won't you? They can't all be wrong. By the way, we do have transcripts available of last week's interview with Bill Black, if you'd like to request one. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.